The following podcast contains adult subject matter. Listener discretion is advised. Comic-Con International, we're here with Joe Casey. He's on New Lieutenants of Metal and 1975, which is coming out fairly shortly.
September,
yeah. So I guess you've done every major Marvel and DC character. You created Ben 10. You've done indie work like all over the place. How'd you land on New Lieutenants of Metal?
Well, it's just another in a long string of weird ideas that I'm lucky enough to be able to actually do and execute and see it go out in the world. It's just something that, I don't know, how do you describe this thing? It's a group of metal-themed heroes that are saving the world on a regular basis, as you do. And it's also, in its own way, a tribute to a style of comic book that was very popular in the early 90s. Basically, the hyper-action books that led into the first Image Comics by the founders, Todd and Jim and Rob, and the rest of those guys, Eric Larson. And for whatever reason, I went through a phase where I was really into the aesthetics of those comics. At the time when I was a kid and they were coming out, I wasn't quite sure about them. But now I see them for the glorious artifacts that they are and the over-the-top style that they reveled in. So I thought, well, that looks like fun. Why don't I give it a shot? The only difference is with New Lieutenants of Metal, having the style of art that we've got, it's a bit incongruous to the style of storytelling that we're doing. But I thought that'd be a good mix. Instead of a genre splice, I call it a style splice. You know, two styles brought together to see what happens.
It's awesome. So, like, visually, it's got that kind of, like, cartoony feel. But,
correct,
like, it's also got, like, you know, people exploding and
that's
stuff
right
in it. And
hyper-violence, hyper-action, over-the-top emotional characters and, you know, all that good stuff from that era.
So it seems like there's like a one, each of the guys is like a different brand of like heavy metal.
Yeah.
Like, did you like research looks or something like that? I mean, cause like walking around at a show, like I can tell you that's the dude into thrash. That's the dude into doom. That's the dude into glam metal, whatever.
Right.
Like, did you kind of like look into that to make these guys?
Well, I mean, I grew up with that stuff, so it wasn't far from my own experience, but yeah, every member of the team does align itself to a certain type of certain side of the metal scene. From, you know, the Mighty Krieg is totally, you know, Judas Priest, leather and studs, and then Mana Warrior is total guar,
nice,
sort of over the top theatrical metal. You know, so it runs the gamut.
That's awesome. So, man, Juan's going to bitch at me because I said that's awesome at the end. I'm not supposed to say that at the end of questions anymore.
Okay.
Sorry.
Yeah, but if you feel it, say it.
I know. That's what I told him, son of a bitch. Anyway, so talk to me about 1975. You say on it that you're creating a brand new iconography. And
right,
I kind of want to know more about what you mean by that.
Well, it's not just another take on Spider-Man or not just another take on any superhero archetype. I went a little further back to the more folk hero kind of archetype, which I feel in a lot of cases ends up having more resonance. It lasts longer. Superheroes tend to be of their time and of the moment, and that's great, and I love superheroes. But for this particular story and for this particular character, I wanted something that was more on the mythological side of things, more on the Joseph Campbell hero with a thousand faces side, which is really weird because it's in everybody's DNA because of things like Star Wars. Everybody of sort of our generation and younger grew up with that type of story. You know, the hero goes on a journey and has to meet the wizard who helps them out and goes through the darkness and comes out the other side. It's in every culture, every kind of parable that's been told over the years. And with superheroes, and even in my own work, just as a sort of creative exercise, I've often tried to get away from that paradigm. It's been done so many times and done so well, but I have to admit there is a real resonance to that type of mythology, those types of stories, those hero journeys. So with Pamela Evans and with 1975, I wanted to embrace it again and see if that kind of mythology, those type of archetypes can exist in new clothes, basically. You know, I mean, these kind of stories have been told all through the generations, but hopefully with 1975, not quite with this type of character, not in this specific milieu, and we'll see what happens. You know?
It's interesting to me because, you know, you've embraced like music and a lot of things. Like 1975 has that soul, New York 70s funk feel to it. And like the trailer, I mean, I would watch that movie like in a heartbeat. You know, if that was a movie, I'd
Yeah, they did
see
a great
it.
Job with that.
You know, Lieutenant's a New Metal, you're putting out, you know, playlists like issue to issue. Like how does music drive you? Like we got to talk to Rick Remender about Deadly Class and how music drives that book. Like how does music drive you in your creative process?
Well, I tend to look sometimes at music as another form of storytelling. A song can tell a story in, you know, three and a half minutes that has its own type of resonance, has its own type of, it, you know, can touch people and really, like, you could take it to heart. Just like a good comic book story, any story. That, to me, is the crossover. Then you have things like style and fashion and genre that also ends up having meaning if you pair it with a certain type of story. With 1975 is obviously period specific, but it is, that music does have a vibe to it and a flavor that fits the story, you know. I don't really kind of know why that is, but maybe it is just a period thing, but I'd rather, if I'm going to see Pamela Evans fight monsters on the page, I'd rather have some, you know, Stevie Wonder Superstition running through my head than some other kind of music. You know, it just seems to fit what we're doing. With New Lieutenants of Metal, I mean, it's right there in the title. It's right there in the playlist that I pick.
Easy, low-hanging fruit on that one. Yeah.
But I mean, that sort of hyperkinetic style of comic works well with that kind of music. You know, I mean, it just goes together really well.
So, you know, between the two comics, there's obviously like a huge visual like divergence. Like when you're approaching a story, like kind of what's your mental process about how you want it to look as you're like writing it?
Well, it comes from the artist, basically. In the case of both of these series, I'd worked with both of these guys before on different things. So I had a sense of what their strengths were, what they might be good at, other than what I'd worked on them with. So with 1975, I knew that Ian McEwan's the artist. From the fill-in issue I had him do on another series I do called Sex, he did those cityscapes so well, he did the kind of street-level action so well, that I'd had this 1975 idea in my head for a little while by that point. When I worked with Ian, I thought, well, that's the guy. It was like playing matchmaker with the right artist for the right idea. And the same with Ulysses on New Lieutenants of Metal. Like I said, it's a style smash or a style splice. So I knew that if I'd gotten somebody to kind of just mimic that early 90s heavy cross-hatching superhero Jim Lee style, the book, I think, would have come off more as a parody than what it's supposed to be, which is a real exploration of the virtues of those comics. And I didn't want that. I wanted people to get into it, and if they enjoyed it for what it is, then I could go back and say, well, what some of what you're enjoying is this early 90s kind of style, and maybe some of what you're enjoying is Ulysses cartoony kind of style that looks, I mean, it's very cool, but it's very incongruous for this type of comic. So for me, there's a bit of experimentation. It's a chemistry set. I'm seeing what works and what doesn't work. And believe me, it hasn't always worked. But in these two particular series, I think it worked really well.
Is there an artist that you've ever thought to yourself, I need to make something because I want to see them create this?
I mean, all the time. That's part of the impetus for all these things, is I see somebody or I work with somebody on one thing, and I think, yeah, they'd be really good for this other thing, which I happen to have an idea for. So that happens all the time. I mean, it's like casting a movie almost. You know, you just try to find something that's right for the person. At the same time, you might see a potential in their work that hasn't been brought out yet. And you feel like I'll have the ego to go, hey, I can bring that out. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't, you know, but I'll always take the shot because it's interesting, because I know if I don't do it, no one else is maybe seeing that artist in that way. So somebody's got to take the shot, you know.
When you're approaching something like this, do you ever have moments where you're working on like New Lieutenants or something that's like really kind of off color or crazy and go, holy crap, like I also made Ben 10. Like, what's wrong with my mind?
Well, yes, I like to think that a lot of my comic book work now is counter programming to the stuff that I do on the TV animation side. Cause it's all kid friendly boys action stuff for the most part. And so when it gives me a real release to go to do a comic book and to say, okay, there are no rules here. There's no censors. There's no S&P I have to worry about. I don't have to worry about anybody even buying it, you know, or liking it. It's a real privilege to have things like Ben 10 that work really well and are very commercial. So that the things I do for myself and for people who maybe follow my comic book work is much more narrow in its focus, you know. But I like that. I like comics that are of a niche, you know. They're for a specific audience. They're not for everybody. And I accept that totally. I mean, I never have any expectation for how things are going to do in the marketplace. If they sell really well, I'm surprised. If they don't sell well, I'm surprised. Because I wouldn't do it if I didn't think it was great, you know. And I never predict if anybody else is going to agree with me or not. You know, it keeps me sane that way.
So when you're crazy prolific, like you got a lot of things going on kind of all the time. When you get a couple seconds to sit down and read a comic book, like what's kind of your go-to right now?
Well, it's difficult because when you're in the business and you've really seen everything behind the scenes, you know, that you can see if you really get into the business and you know how the sausage is made, it gets tough to appreciate new comics. Because I know everybody that's making them, usually. And occasionally, if somebody I don't know comes out with something great, then I'll really latch onto it. Like Michel Fife and Copra. Now I know Michel. But when I first encountered his work, I didn't know him at all. So I was real excited to get that book. And it was my favorite book at the time. So I'm always on the lookout for that stuff. Now, beyond that, I find myself buying a lot of old comics, even stuff that I read when I was a kid, because I'm always curious to see things that I loved as a kid with the perspective of having been in the business for 20 years. What's that comic book like now? Is it still as good as I remember it to be? And if it's not what I remembered, what is it about it that maybe still holds up or is still resonant for me? Now that ends up, that means I end up buying a lot of comics. And I'm like, oh, I can't believe I just rebought this. But I tend to do a lot of what I call the dumpster dives, which are the, you know, the 50-cent boxes, the dollar boxes. So it's not, I'm not taking too much of a hit. If it's something that I remembered from my childhood and I rebuy and I'm like, oh, I should not have reread that. I should not have looked at that again. Then I can maybe give it to my kids or something. Say, here you go. It worked for me when I was 7. Maybe it'll work for you now.
I did that with Executioner's Song.
Oh, yeah?
I was like, oh, man, I don't want to find all the single issues, so I tracked down like the one version of the trade paperback, and then I read it. I was like, oh, mistakes were made. Like, this book is terrible. And in the introduction, they're like, sorry about that. Like, it was awful.
But see, at least they owned up to it. But I actually think those comics, like I was saying, they have value. They have some inherent value beyond just nostalgia. And I don't know what it is. I keep trying to figure it out because I'll buy comics that I know are bad. Old and bad. I just know it. But there's something about it. I know humans made it. I know there was, at the time, they put work into it. They put energy into it. And either I'm paying some weird form of tribute to that, or I know there might be something in there that might set me on some inspirational course that I wasn't on before. So I'm always, it's like chasing the dragon, you know, the drug addicts. I'm always chasing the dragon. And I am always chasing the dragon when it comes to comics. I'm looking for that piece of inspiration or something that I wasn't aware of before. And there are pockets of things that I didn't even read when I was a kid that I can go back and, like, I'll give you, for instance, the Doug Mensch, Paul Gulacy Master of Kung Fu. that wasn't a comic I read as a kid.
Right.
It was a little before my time as a young reader. But so to go back and get those comics as an adult and study them, they're great.
They're funny.
They're fantastic.
They're so weird. And I love the covers. Like, I have a bunch of them that I had bought in, like, a box somewhere. And
right.
Every one that I've read, I'm like, this is amazing.
Yeah. They're fantastic. And not just from a – they're of their time, but they're timeless at the same time. The craft in it, a Paul Galassi in full Steranko mode. Doug Minch completely overwriting, you know, panels packed with dialogue and
the huge text boxes and stuff. Yeah.
Whereas, you know, if I was using that metric on myself, I might go, I don't know, I may be overdoing it. But for some reason, when they did it, it's amazing. I love it. I can't get enough of it. So things like that, I'm always on the lookout for.
That's awesome. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time. How can people find you on social media to keep track of the billions of projects that you're working on?
They can go to my company's website, manofaction.tv. I'm not on Twitter. I'm not on Facebook.
Probably a smart move.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I said I was prolific. That's how I'm prolific.
Nice.
I stay off social media as much as possible.
That's awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time. Like, I really hope everybody goes out and picks up 1975 and New Lieutenants of Metal. So thank you so much, man.
Thanks a lot.
Awesome.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast. Join us on Facebook and Twitter to get behind-the-scenes information for exclusive content and to be notified when new episodes are available. The thoughts and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the individual and do not necessarily represent or reflect those of the Thinking Outside the Long Walks podcast, Baron Space Productions, its partners, or affiliates. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is made available by its creators, Juan, John, and Gabe. The podcast is edited and produced by Juan, and Albie is the co-executive producer. The Thinking Outside the Long Box podcast is a Baron Space production.